welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and I'm joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the best and worst of the decade. And Richard, I thought we'd do something a little different today. This is our final podcast of 2019, and thus our final podcast of the decade. So we're going to take a look back at the 2010s. And I asked you in preparation for this show, we do occasionally prepare, hard as that may be to believe, to identify...
Well, I mean, we fake it at least.
to identify what you thought were some of the best and worst events or trends of the decade that we're completing. So I'll toggle between best and worst. I was actually a bit surprised by your first best, which was the development of a coherent classical liberal movement. Surprised for two reasons, Richard. One, it's implicit in that you don't think there was much of a coherent movement prior to this decade. And two, we are also, as we've talked about before on the show, in the midst of probably the most sustained attack on classical liberal principles from within the conservative movement that we've seen in decades, at least. So explain what you mean by this.
Well, now that you put it that way, I'm not so sure that I'm right. But the argument that I was making is, you know, I've been involved in this for a very, very long time. And what happens is it's very difficult to know where you're going to find your allies. You certainly don't find your allies on this thing by going to the sacred halls of academe, which, if anything, move further and further to the left. So there are people who have classical liberal inclinations about them, but they're not necessarily self-described as classical liberal. I guess the thing that I was thinking about, in fact, I know the thing that I was thinking about this, was what I see to be the most important transformation of the Trump age, which is the rejuvenation of the judiciary with, I guess, now 50 appellate appointments and probably twice as many district court judges. And for the first time in my life, when I start looking at the bench, I start seeing a bunch of people whose attitudes on constitutional law and interpretation, in many ways, they don't perfectly replicate my own, but they're certainly overall sympathetic to it. So there is not amongst any of these new judges any strong sentiment or allegiance to social democratic or a New Deal ideals. It's not that judges are necessarily going to disregard all the precedents, but this is very different to respect precedent than to enthusiastically expand it, and I don't see that. What I do see, in effect, is a kind of a real appreciation with respect to the structural limitations associated with limited government. We hear a lot more talk now about separation of powers. We hear a lot more talk now about the limitation of the delegation doctrines associated with the administrative state. We actually see some serious discussions coming back about federalism. Property rights are no longer a pariah, at least in the circles in which I move and start to talk. It's obviously very, very early in this kind of a movement, because by definition, there are no Trump judges that have served even as long as 3 years. But as you know something about them, and many of them, I'm happy to say, are people who have been my former students or associates in one way or another, what you can do is you can start to see that there is a kind of nascent grouping here on this stuff, and it's going to make its way up to the Supreme Court. If you wanted to have just a couple of illustrations on the point, probably the capstone doctrine of modern American administrative law for the last 35 years has been a case called Chevron against the National Defense Research Council. And it's quite clear that the deference on questions of law to administrative agencies is now a position which has very determined opponents. Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch are leading the charge in the Supreme Court. People like Justice Thomas, who used to be on the other side of this issue, seem to be migrating over. It seems to me that right now you probably have at least three justices who are going to take this position. I think Alito probably going to move the same way. The conservative judge, I think, who's most reluctant to move on anything, at least without a clear majority, is Justice Roberts. But all of this stuff is in play. And I think that's extremely important. The delegation doctrine is all of a sudden in play. The famous quip of Cass Sunstein is the non-delegation doctrine has had two good years, but 200 bad ones, or actually one good year. That's clearly about to change, because what's happened is the ambition in trying to create these delegations increases. There's now some kind of a pushback. And so I think, in effect, that the classical liberal stuff inside the judiciary is taking place. And then the question is, as I think my own mission, and I hope others academics do it, is to sort of give an academic version of the same principles that will resonate with these judges. So in this decade, I did write a book which was called, appropriately enough, The Classical Liberal Constitution, which tried to set out the way in which this approach cashed itself out in multiple areas. And I think that it's going to have some impact, and I think many other people are starting to move in the same direction. So there's something of a cadre. I mean, to put it in a slightly different direction, you know, I've trained many, many students over the years, many of whom actually believe in this stuff. What I now notice amongst my students, recent graduates and so forth, is the following observation that comes to me from many of the judges who asked me for help. They said, there is a fierce competition for smart conservative and libertarian type clerks because so many of the judges are looking at the same kind of pool. And I think it's fair to say that in the years that Obama was making the appointments, it was rare, if at all, that any new judge would ever call me about anything. And that's certainly not the way in which the game is playing out today. So I think, in effect, judges outlive presidents, impeached or not impeached, by a very long period of time. And so I do think that this is an intellectual trend. I think people on the left actually agree with me about the trend. They may find it ominous, which I do not. But I do think, in effect, in that particular sense, what I said actually makes sense.
When I asked you for bad trends, the very first thing that you mentioned was global warming. But you meant by that not global warming itself, but the state of the conversation around global warming. You think there's too much fear embedded in the way that we talk about this. Explain that.
Well, the fear is one of the parts. The thing that is most characteristic about it is that it's morphed into other sorts of things. The recent meeting with respect to the Paris Accords and the efforts to try and revise the quotas, the whole thing has fallen apart, as one expected it would. But the only thing that came out of this was a further commitment to gender equity in trying to work through the field. And so what's happened is the movement itself has become co-opted as part of a large set of progressive causes, most of which I think are rather dubious, and I would not defend them on their own rights, but they're being merged together. And when they come together, it makes it very hard to keep the science separate. And if you start looking at the now, I think, aborted Green New Deal, it was actually the same kind of progression that started to take place. This was treated as a lever to try to transform the structure of American society so as to increase the total control that government would have over the means of production. There are no class liberals who are in the Green New Deal, and there are many socialists who are there. So that is, I think, what the political background is. On the intellectual side, yes, I do think that there is a panic about what is going on. And it's very hard to try to explain what's wrong with the current thing, but I'm going to try in a somewhat cryptic fashion to tell you why it is I'm completely uneasy about the way in which the movement works. First of all, I mean, there's a simple question about what is the effect of carbon dioxide with respect to temperature? And the simple answer that one has is carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. Greenhouse gases trap heat inside the atmosphere, and so the planet is going to get very, very much warmer than it otherwise is. But this story is really very, very incomplete for a number of reasons. One, it also turns out that greenhouse gases repel sunlight coming in, so there is a very complicated equilibrium between what's retained and what's kept out. More importantly, if you're trying to look at greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide is in relative tiny quantities. We forget you're talking about, you know, 400 parts per million as opposed to 350 parts per million. And if one can see a revolution in those, you know, 50 parts per million, they're more astute at this than I am. More importantly is if you start looking at what the most potent greenhouse gas is, it's water vapor. And, you know, this is basically 25 times more common and probably four times as parallel. And so somehow or other, you're thinking that the entire story, when you start to look at it, is driven by the minor gas rather than by the major gas. And I don't think that that becomes credible in dealing with the long run. And the third part of the basic theory is that it's wrong to describe carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas if what you mean is it's the only thing that it is a greenhouse gas. It turns out both carbon dioxide and water vapor are the driving constituents for photosynthesis, and they have a much more powerful effect on plant growth than they do with with respect to temperature. It's really strong. There are no other conflating factors in the way in which the model works. And so now that they've both increased at some level, the amount of green coverage on the surface of the Earth is up by about 13 or 14% in the last 30 years, which is a non-trivial amount. It's basically the size of North and South America. And when you start getting greening, what happens is the median doesn't move very rapidly. And it also turns out that the colds get less cold and the warms get less warm. So there's a more stable situation. There were many more 100-degree days in New York City when I was a boy growing up than there are today. If you look at any one of these maps, by far the decade with the most highs was the 1930s. Since 2010, I think there are only two records that are set on high temperatures and so forth, which is kind of showing you what's going on. There is a number that I like to quote, which most people want to ignore, which is if you look at the period between February 2016 and February 2018, we had a two-year decline in temperature equal to 1 degree Fahrenheit or 0.56 degrees centigrade, roughly speaking, which is larger than the target reduction that have been called for by the various people who say we really have to tighten down on this. And people look at me and they say, you know, this is a function of natural variation. I said, that's not an answer. That basically conceals the fundamental question, which there's something else in that which explains that natural variation. You have to figure out what it is. What you cannot do is to explain natural variation if you have this very simple-minded formula where you have carbon dioxide as the only serious independent variable and temperature is the only serious dependent variable. At that point, the temperatures that we see are going up and down, and the carbon dioxide is only going up. So you've got to bring something else into this, whether it's celestial forces, El Nino, volcanic actions, tides, whatever it is that's going on, you need to have a more comprehensive theory. And the last point, just on the straight science, is we know that most of the various kinds of things that we see tend to be cyclical. And cyclical is not something which could be explained by temperatures, by carbon dioxide just going up. So hurricanes have tended to ebb and flow in the various ways. The rise in sea level has been pretty consistent over 10,000 years, but sometimes it's a little bit more rapid, sometimes it's a little bit less rapid. And what happens is if you just look at parts of the cycle, the parts that are going up, you could panic and ignore the parts that are going down. So for all of these particular reasons, it seems to me that we have to be a lot more careful about this, and you have to worry about other kinds of dangers that you want to deal with, and namely traditional forms of pollution, such as that which is emitted from soft coal, which has a lower level of carbon dioxide, but a much higher level of various other kinds of toxic chemicals. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I would much rather stop immediate large numbers of death than engage in this speculative hunt, but trying to find major ways to stop the carbon dioxide. And then if you start looking at where the carbon dioxide protection is really churning, you can't run a global agreement if you don't have China with a 30% share of the total emissions and building more coal plant. And you cannot but ignore the fact that the single most efficient nation in increasing output per unit of carbon dioxide and reducing virtually every other kind of reliance on raw materials is the United States. So I think, in effect, if you're going to go through this kind of thing, what you really have to do is to take a deep breath and ask yourself whether you're chasing the wrong particular famine. If there is some kind of damage with carbon dioxide supported by stronger evidence, I'm not going to say do nothing about it. But at this particular point in time, it seems to me that the data goes one way and the rhetoric is so extreme on the other direction that one starts to believe of this as a matter of faith. If that young girl Greta is able to win a Times Person of the Year award, then we're in very bad shape indeed. She has no idea of what she's talking about. And I think it's really rather tragic that a poor, somewhat impressionable child can be used as a poster child for a political movement which should really stand on its intellectual legs, which at the moment I think are rather weak.
Another negative that you pointed to, and then we'll go back and end on an up note.
Okay.
But you referenced Twitter, and I take this as less about the service itself than about the kind of social dynamics that it's unleashed. But explain this for us.
Look, I love communications and I hate mob rule. One of the things that I think that has become quite possible with respect to the internet is that if you wish to mobilize your forces today, you can do so with incredible rapidity. And often you do so in an effort to punish individuals whose speech or behavior is somewhat opposite to your own. And so what we do is we see these mass boycotts beginning, these denunciations starting to take place. And it turns out that various kinds of marginalized groups are not the traditional marginalized groups, but you want to take a vulnerable group in the United States. You know, certain kinds of Christian fundamentalists are really outgunned in the political arena. Gay and lesbian groups are extremely strong. And so what I think that you're starting to see through all of this stuff is a rapid degree of polarization and a lack of sophistication and a lack of caution in the way in which public debate goes. And I don't mean to exempt the Republicans from that. If you're trying to figure about the man who in many ways is the cardinal abuser of Twitter, try the United States President Donald Trump, who every time I see him on the air, I say, oh my God, what is he about to do now? Why can't he just remain quiet, which I think is congenitally impossible for him. So I do think, in effect, that we really find out that shouting can drive out more considered deliberation. And you see it in the polarization that takes place in American politics. You see it, for example, in the polarization that has taken place with respect to global warming.
Final positive note. This is an interesting observation because this is something so subtle that it doesn't get a lot of attention. But you say that we're having a sort of quiet revolution in safety and efficiency that's been underappreciated. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, it's what happens is the way in which the spectacular presentation of information starts to take place is anytime there is a disaster, it will get very strong coverage. But every time you have a new technique which is quite beneficial and it saves lives, it goes unnoticed. So the statistic that I like to start out with on this thing is just a very simple one, which says what's the level of adverse events in a whole variety of areas and its decline rate since, say, 1993, 25, 26 years ago. Whether you're talking about medical imaging, whether you're talking about medical liability, whether you're talking about pipelines, leaks, accidents of any sort, the basic rule of thumb in these areas is that all of these accidents are down by about 75%. So instead of getting four, you start to get one. If you want a simple observation, ask yourself, when was the last time that we've had a commercial airline which has crashed? I mean, we just don't report them. As a kid in the 1950s, you always had your heart in your hand because you never knew there might be a run of these things at one point or another. And so what does this mean? It means that products are safer, automobiles are infinitely better. If you go into medical procedures today, the finest care that you get in 1970 is utterly primitive relative to the standard that anybody gets when they walk into an emergency room penniless, because the overall techniques are so great. If you look at malpractice and product liability cases that are based on serious flaws of product, these things have started to go way down. If you're trying to figure out what the sources of death are, it's not workplace accidents, it's not medical accidents, so forth. It's the kind of thing that maybe we can cure and maybe we cannot, but you have to start to think about this when you start looking at something like opioid addiction as a serious source of death, or AIDS in AIDS or something like that. Those numbers are way down on the AIDS side because we've got the cures, and on the opioid side, it's going up because there's so much willful destruction. Another way of looking at this is to sort of figure out what aggregate statistics look like. And here I'm going to do something which I'd like to do. I'm going to give a plug to a book, and it's a book by Johan Norborg, and it's called Progress. And it says, I'm going to give you 10 reasons why it is that you ought to look to the future in an optimistic way. And this book is absolutely relentless in the way in which it presents the data on a whole variety of situations which sort of indicate food supplies are way up, sanitation is better, life expectancy, particularly in underpoverished areas, a vast increase. Poverty is down, violence is down, even things like pollution and so forth are down, literacy is up. Freedom, well, when he wrote this book a couple of years ago, it was up, but then there's China, and we're really not quite sure which way that's going. But that's not a technological point, that's a political point, and politics doesn't have any anything remotely like the unilateral movement in all these other areas. So that if you actually start looking at what's gone on, all the unsung heroes are those people who have managed to improve every one of the vectors that I've just started to talk about. Most of it is done through market efficiencies on the one hand, by some kinds of charitable interventions. I think the lesson that you take away when you start looking at the Norberg book is you don't see government as being a really powerful and influential source in this particular area. All of the stuff, in fact, seems to be coming out of market institutions, particularly in the way in which they spread in third world countries, Africa and so forth, where life expectancies are way, way up relative to before. And, you know, ultimate measures of well-being, I think, are in fact the single most important thing you want to look like. And so with all the tumult and all the craziness that we start to see in the United States, these particular sorts of numbers, I think, are improving. Basically, there is a kind of a necessary law here. It's what I like to call the square root linear law. So that it takes you, whatever it says, it takes you 100 to go from 100 to 10. To knock down things by an order of magnitude, it's going to take you another 100 to go from 10 to 1. That is, as you start getting all rid of all the low-hanging fruit, most of these other interventions are going to be much more difficult to try to deal. So if you want to have a simple advantage, you know, getting from 5 to 50 or 60 miles an hour, you know, that started to take you by going from basically by horse and buggy to the railroads. Then you could go another order of magnitude, you know, to planes. You save much less by going from 50 to 500 than you do from 5 to 50, right? I mean, in terms of the number of days that it starts to take and so forth. And when you want to go the next to 5,000, well, you're never going to get there with respect to the kinds of things that you're talking about with respect to speed. And so what you're going to do is you're going to come to certain kinds of ultimate limits in particular sorts of areas. Miniaturization can no longer really be thought to be sensible for things like transportation. We obviously will have more of it with respect to communications, but you start reaching certain kinds of natural limits, and then you start trying to find other ways in which you can innovate along different kinds of dimensions. But you would expect that the progress rate will be somewhat lower, but we still got a long way to go with basic things like sanitation and so forth. And I think that the world in general has done a pretty good job. And what I'd like to do is to say the people whom we ought to thank are the people whom we don't know. It's not celebrities. It's often bench scientists and innovators and entrepreneurs who get these things to market. And they may make some money for themselves, which, God bless you, is just fine. They give it away anyhow. But what they really do is they bring elementary precautions and safety devices to mass people on the earth. And that's the single most important development in the second decade of the 21st century. And so I'd like to end on an optimistic note rather than a pessimistic one.
All right. Well, we can certainly do that. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column. It's called The Libertarian, and it's at definingideas@hoover.org. You can also follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Croy Senek. We'll see you in 2020. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.